Tape 116 provided an outline of the discovery and recovery of 152 codices from Central America. In tape 117, we provided also an outline of the translations, interpretations of many of these codices, and the background materials that archaeologists, anthropologists, and others had been able to derive from the source materials. Most of this material has been recovered and provided in English translation in just the last 10 to 20 years. Tape 117, we were dealing with the gods and doctrines of Central America, and in particular, we were concerned with the god Quetzalcoatl. In that tape, we had reached a point where there was a twist in the legends. Previously, an adversary god had been represented by the morning star. In the particular legend we were talking about at that moment, there was a twist, and here now the morning star is the hero. Quetzalcoatl and his many brothers are involved in a great struggle with the night and the other stars. Perhaps this reflects a carryover of the ancient information and doctrines of the East, where we have a group of individuals, early born, who are in contest and conflict with a firstborn and a god called Quetzalcoatl. Now, as we continue on with the study of the gods and the doctrines of Central America, we'll deal with the episodes that Quetzalcoatl disappeared for a time into the underworld, where he provided himself with atlatl darts and other paraphernalia in order that he might accomplish a certain purpose there. We've considered the lineaments of an ancient Mesoamerican god known as Quetzalcoatl. He had four different appearances, which we mentioned in tape 117. And now we're introduced to an additional transfiguration. This individual was not fully divine. He had once been a living man. It seemed that there was a point where all was imperiled, for the high priest came bringing a new gospel and reformer zeal in one of the ancient city centers where Quetzalcoatl seemed to have resided for a period of time, and disturbed the orthodoxy of his time, which was really an apostasy from an ancient religion. In fact, one of our sources say that we see behind this particular episode and activity the introduction of a new and revealed religion. It dates about the time of Christ. It involved an individual who had been sent down from heaven to reform men and turn them from their impious and impious ways. To achieve this end, this individual, this god, formed a group of special priests with voices like trumpets, who called the people to penance and the new light, calling them to understand that which had been revealed. This Quetzalcoatl first went to the city at Tulancingo and for 4 years practiced extreme abstinence in this area. The Book of Mormon gives us a great account of the appearance of Jesus Christ here upon the continent. We don't know the exact location of the city to which he appeared, but at least there is among the Central Americans traditions of such a type of appearance and the content of what happened there. It seems as a result of this great appearance at this great city, mankind's guilt was gradually being purged. Sloth and envy, however, began to creep in, and finally eventual gloom descended once more over the land. In the Book of Mormon, it states that 200 years or more were required before that kind of decadence set in. And these ancient documents point out that omens begin to appear again, presaging the fall of the ancient city to which Quetzalcoatl had appeared, and three sorcerers. Could this be the three Nephites were translated? At any rate, there was a reinstatement of the cult of human sacrifice. From all of this, we see that Quetzalcoatl's most outstanding characteristic was one of holiness, which in turn was derived from his priestly office, for he is considered to be the chief presiding priest. He was the one who first taught men to invoke the gods, how to pray properly, and to erect temples, and to institute rituals, fasting, chastity, and midnight bathing in icy waters, and other penances were at the core of his teaching. For he saw that unless the priesthood, as a surrogate for all men, was penitentially involved at all times, the gods would withhold abundance and leave men defenseless. This reform movement no doubt belonged in this ancient period, and it's a complex preservation that's come down to us through time. It is not possible to doubt the objective existence of a remarkable priestly figure whose piety and subsequent expulsion from an imperial city affected the imagination of later people. The Aztecs could still lament this individual's fate hundreds of years afterward. Now, in tape 116 and 117 and this particular one, we're using the names generally used by the Aztecs for most of the gods and their episodes. Now, as we return to the study here, even more significant than the tale of Quetzalcoatl and his adversary, Tezcatlipoca, was the prophecy of the return and the reclamation of imperial power by Quetzalcoatl. The year 1519, we mentioned in tape 117 in the Christian calendar, happened to correspond roughly to the fateful year of the prophecy, one read in the Mexican calendar. In that year, Hernando Cortes came out of the Gulf of Mexico from the east to make his landfall in the Aztec Empire. Moctezuma II understandably believed that the Spaniards were the descendants of Quetzalcoatl and that Cortes was the spokesman of the god himself. Earlier, they even thought that perhaps he was the god. The god could only be the imperial figure far off over the sea to the east to whom Cortes said he paid allegiance because Cortes declined to consider himself deity. This astounding historic coincidence, purely fortuitous, of the calendrical moment of prophetic fulfillment with Cortes, deprived Moctezuma of the will to resist, with consequences fatal to himself and his people and to the Western Hemisphere. In 1550, some of the Zapotecs rose in rebellion, claiming that Quetzalcoatl had indeed redeemed his promise and returned to lead them. Near to Mexico City, it was held as late as 1670 that the god's line survived and was soon returned to reclaim the imperial privileges. In the records of the Shalom Balam and the Codex Perez, the interesting statement states that in the Khatun 11 Awa, when being counted, foreigners would arrive in this country, and at that time, Christianity actually came. And the prophecies of the great Shalom Balam would be fulfilled, those prophecies referring to all that was to happen in the age before the arrival of the conquistadors. Much of Shalom Balam seems to have been fulfilled in some interesting respect. Now the god, Quetzalcoatl, seems to have passed over the eastern sea and promised to return and usher in the end of the world. Their expectation was that when he did come, it would be very near the winding up scene. Now, in fact, if any city could claim to be the holy center of the ancient Aztec world, that city would be Cholula. The fact that Cholula was the focus of so much piety and the constant coming and goings of its people made it exceedingly rich. Archaeologists may want to work with the evidences of that ancient city, see if there might be some parallel to one of the cities mentioned in the Book of Mormon to which Quetzalcoatl made his appearances. There is in that city, Cholula, a pyramid temple, the most massive structure ever built in pre-Columbian world. It was an ancient structure, and it has a very ancient earlier foundation, its first or innermost terrace being dated about the first century, which would be about the time the Book of Mormon records the coming of Christ here. It was contemporary, therefore, with the early Teotihuacan north of Mexico City. Cholula lasted into the centuries and was active until about 500 A.D., when another altar was erected at the base of the pyramid, being carved in the relief of two plumed serpents. By this time, apostasy was nearly totally and complete in the Western Hemisphere. Now, of the great gods, Quetzalcoatl was the only one who might be considered close to the Aztecs, for though a god, he had had a mortal body and had died, or at least slipped away. Now, the two lord and two lady who sit in the state with Quetzalcoatl, also known as Lord Sustenance and Lady Sustenance, and elsewhere identified as the great god and goddess, there's an association. They determine or affirm that a child should come into being, whereat Quetzalcoatl makes the child. In this capacity, Quetzalcoatl is called creator and maker, but we can see that he is more agent than principal. And perhaps bearing this myth is the declaration of the firstborn of the only begotten. Ascertaining divine jurisdiction in this field, we find that as a creator and maker, an agent in principle, that all men were created, but Tezcatlipoca, the adversary, remained their master. In other words, there was a tendency among the Aztecs to tie a significant part of man's allegiance to Quetzalcoatl, but time and time again they irritated the fact that he had created the first human couple and that he continues to create each child as it is born. And his priesthood went even further. They sometimes claimed that he created the world and all things in it, an arrogation of supremacy, more properly really belonging to a higher god. This same supremacy, however, was also claimed for Tezcatlipoca. Where does it teach that Tezcatlipoca or his equivalent Lucifer claimed to be the god and creator of this world? We might have reference to some of Mormon doctrines in the Purgate Price. Now this cultural hero, Quetzalcoatl, apparently is said to have alone invented the all-important framework of time and destiny. In all these instances, we see Quetzalcoatl standing midway between gods in the higher levels and men, and acting as a patron of the skills and needs of men. Precisely the role of Jesus Christ. According to one tradition, the Mexican throne had belonged to Quetzalcoatl himself, who had been its legendary first incumbent, the very first king. The corollary of these beliefs was that when Quetzalcoatl returned as prophesied in the year 1 read, the Mexican ruler, whoever he might be, and in this instance it was Moctezuma II, would be required to relinquish his powers and the aspects and regalia that he had to the rightful heir. The seeming accusation of the prophecy was on that fateful day in 1519. However, it totally undermined the Mexican state. Moctezuma felt himself especially threatened because it was he who sat on the throne that belonged to Quetzalcoatl. Now that he yielded to Cortes without conquest was not really astonishing to anyone of his day. It is to us looking back historically, and of course it resulted finally in Moctezuma's own death. In the Codex Borgia, and we might make some little statement here in regard to the various codices that we'd referred to in 116 and also in 117. While they are prime religious documents and sources, one has to be very careful because only those which might have accompanying texts in Spanish or Italian, all the others require greater caution. The very greatest caution as far as that matter goes, for the interpretation of any particular scene might be questionable. But many of the codices recovered from Dresden, Paris, Madrid, and elsewhere had interlinear Spanish and sometimes Italian, and so can to some extent be considered to have valid interpretation. But as yet we cannot read the great codices fully. To return again to the Codex Borgia, Tezcatlipoca is depicted as having possessed himself of all of Quetzalcoatl's regalia. He imitated this ancient god. And we do not find the reverse, however. Quetzalcoatl never pretended to or imitated or depicted himself as being Tezcatlipoca. In the Toltec cycle, predecessors to the Aztecs, it was Tezcatlipoca who finally subdued Quetzalcoatl, tempting him to his fall and subsequent exile. And once we even hear of a sacrifice performed in the temple of Tezcatlipoca. The Aztecs then did not believe that the cosmos was perfectly balanced between opposites. To him, the ancient people of Central America, it was essentially dark and hostile. As far as a balanced dichotomy between spirit and matter, he never made any distinction really between them, believing them to be one thing. Spirit and matter was of one substance. In terms of one of the goddesses and a thought referred to in tapes 80 and 90 that we've had earlier on Mesoamerica, there was the midwife of the night, the goddess who directed the events connected with birth. And in the words of a midwife, there was references as she conducted a particular tender and comfortable moment with a newborn. References were made to the goddess and the God who had reared originally the young child in a celestial home. As a matter of fact, we find that the ancestral spirits are conceived as stars, and that many of the stars were the brothers of Quetzalcoatl. So things do crop up in these ancient legends and stories that are reminiscent of very peculiar Mormon doctrine. In terms of the quality of an individual's life, this is addressed to him at times. You have come to reach the earth, the place of torment, the place of pain, where it is hot, where it is cold, where the wind blows, in a place of one's affliction, of one's weariness, a place of thirst, a place of hunger, a place where one freezes, a place of weeping. It is not true that it is a good place. It is a place of weeping, a place of sorrow, a place where one suffers. Certainly it is a dangerous place, a revolting place, and a painful and an afflicting place. But then similar things are pretty well found in most of the nations of the world in describing this particular earth life. And what about man and his fate? It was a predisposition which acted upon individuals. It did not act upon mankind at large, however, this predisposition. But an individual seemed to have had a destiny, a certain predetermined or foreordained destiny. Fate operated on a man, however, fundamentally to his essence. The day he had been born was often the key. But this had to be interpreted by a priest skilled in the matter, one whose learning had come down to him from Quetzalcoatl himself. Thus, every child came into the world with a ready-made destiny, which was provided him. Is there a parallel here to patriarchal blessings? But no matter what or how clearly stated, the destiny could still be altered. Free will entered there. It was not predetermined wholly or predestined. The destiny was outlined, and it could be altered. It could be weakened or slipped away, especially in the case of a very young child. And adjustments could then be attempted to recover or to restore. Or man could, by his own willful negligence, forsake his destiny, even as it were, just simply give it up. Death and the soul and the underworld were part of the doctrines associated with the gods of the ancient Central Americans, and specifically the concept of annihilation of the soul was rejected by the great leaders and teachers of these ancient peoples. When we die, they said, it is not that we die, for still we live. We are resurrected. We still live. We awaken. Statements like these were attributed to the Aztecs and to their predecessors, the ancient people who had constructed the great pyramids north of Mexico, understood that this certainly formed part of their beliefs as well. These expectations of immortality had many parallels. And the early conquistadors and Franciscan and Dominion priests saw this. The geography of hell, however, was rather interesting. It's always been fascinating to everybody and many nations. And we might note that the extinction of the soul on its arrival in the lowest region is at variance with the concept of continuing life. One group of Central Americans, the Mictlan, believed in a sort of extinction, and yet it must have been the same way that a light goes out and then is replaced again, because the individual continued in an undifferentiated cloud of spirits located in the far north, ancestral spirits. He rejoined ancestral spirits in a place to the far north in terms of the geography to await whatever may be his destiny. There was in the ancient Central American a sort of trinity of war, sacrifice, and cannibalism, made up a combined religious service with all its parts carefully articulated. War, as we pretty well know and understand, was thought to have been created and to be in behalf, in one way, sacrifice itself. Certainly most of the human sacrifices were taken from prisoners, and there was a constant activity to obtain prisoners of war to be utilized in sacrifices. The Aztecs were fascinated by the subject of war. It molded many, perhaps most, of their institutions. The Book of Mormon is a book of wars, constant, persistent, pervasive. But put summarily, war was created by the gods and came down from above. However, the Aztecs assigned the creation of war to a single god, His name, as we would anticipate, yes, Tezcatlipoca, the adversary. A very interesting parallel there. The paraphernalia of sacrifice is rather interesting. Attached to many of the temples was customarily a skull rack, generally a high lattice work constructed of long poles, horizontally arranged in tiers, one above the other. After a captor had offered his friend a feast of the choice parts of the body of his slain captive, the skull was then defleshed. If that of a commoner and taken to the temple where he had been sacrificed, if the skull belonged to a nobleman or a great captain, the skin and hair were left on, and the priest knocked holes in the side of the skull and strung them along the poles. I have many descriptions from some of the earlier priests who described, particularly the Dominican priests, and in some of their codices and some of their writings, they have drawn pictures of these lattices of skulls strung along poles. The Aztec knew of at least six varieties of human sacrifice. Heart extraction was the main one utilized, but there was also immolation, shooting with arrows and beheading, the destruction of children, and also self-sacrifice, auto-sacrifice. The sacrifice of children belonged exclusively to the cult of Tolok, the rain god, and undoubtedly goes back to some of the La Venta practices in the pre-classic period or to the time of the Jaredites, up to 1800 B.C. The problem of the disposal of the cadavers in all their tremendous accelerated human sacrifices did not seem to be a problem, for in most cases, warriors and merchants individually claimed the bodies belonging to them at the bottom of the great staircase. After their hearts removed from them, they were thrown down the staircases, ended up at the bottom. There they were claimed and taken home to serve in the feast. The hearts, which had been presented to the god for his consumption, were later cooked and eaten by the priests who retained the heart at the top of the temples. Cannibalism was a pervasive aspect of the cultures of Mesoamerica. How horrible. The Otomi, for instance, after sacrificing a victim, cut him up in slices and sold the chunks in the marketplace. Before they had ever entered the basin, the primitive Chichimecs killed men for the sole purpose of eating them. Only later did they offer the victim first to the god. The taste for human flesh was well developed, therefore, among the Aztecs and their predecessors, and the part of the sacrificed person not claimed by the captor or the priest could be sold on the market. One thigh of every victim in Mexico was customarily reserved for the palace, and in all such matters, they were quite greedy. As indicated above, commoners, including women, might occasionally partake of human flesh, but by and large, its consumption was a privilege reserved for the nobility, the merchants, and the priests. The meal was generally prepared as a corn stew with pieces of flesh mixed in. We might call this a human succotash, and could particularly be enjoyed with squash flour as a savory. It was a favorite Aztec dish. In summary, then, we find difficult to understand in all of this how the Aztecs could have placed war and its corollary and sacrifice at the very center of their universe. But Tezcatlipoca was apparently considered to have overthrown Quetzalcoatl. There was no expectation that the quarrel would ever be renewed, at least so they now believed. But there is a cutoff point in the ability of a society to be continually augmented with such nightmare practices, let alone to continue to insist upon them as being axial. Terrors beyond endurance will finally cause a society to crumble or to revolt. Just read the closing life of Mormon. He didn't even want to go into the discussion of the things that the individuals were engaged in. There are three early Spanish sources who were of the opinion that the Aztecs felt human sacrifice to be unsupportable. Even the Aztec priests, finally in the 15th and 16th century, said one source, in their hearts desired to be freed of such an intolerable burden. A well-known belief of theirs clearly reveals their suffocated horror and feelings of guilt connected with human sacrifice. We've already mentioned the night axe, one of Tezcatlipoca's disguises, a phantom which moved about only in the night. He could be heard in the distance as the thudding sound of a woodsman's axe. He was a headless man with a horrible wound in his chest, with which awful regularity opened and then shut again.
Those who are analysts and psychologically inclined will be able to find the horrors of this, finally emerging in the peoples as a whole. But obviously, the ruined cadavers, the human sacrifices of such great quantities, so common to the sight of all Aztecs, had finally returned to haunt them. Now, Delonda, Diego de Delonda's account of the affairs of Yucatan, after he had burnt many of the books there in Northern Merida, I've been in the particular edifice that he erected after he had broken down so-called heathen idols, taken a picture of Delonda, turned out very well. But we now go back to him because he had, oddly enough, in his own writings, retained for us a great deal of his understanding of the peoples. Here's a summary by Delonda. These people have always believed in the immortality of the soul more than many other peoples, even though they may not be so civilized, for they believe that there was a more excellent life after death, which the soul enjoyed on departure from the body. They said that this future life was divided into a good and a bad life, into a painful one and one full of peace. They said that the bad and the painful one was for the wicked, and the good and the delightful one for those who had lived well according to their beliefs. The easy life, which they said they would achieve if they were good, was to go to a very pleasant place, where nothing would give them pain, and where they would have an abundance of food and drink, of great sweetness, and a tree which is there, which is very cool and shady, beneath whose branches and shade they would all rest and take pleasure for eternity. The punishment for a bad life, which they said that the wrongdoers would have to suffer, was to go to a lower place than the others, which they called Mitnal, meaning hell, and there to be tormented by devils, and by great extremes of hunger, cold, fatigue, and misery, unending suffering. There was also in this place a devil, a prince of all the devils, whom all obeyed. And they called him in their tongue, Juan Hua. They claimed that these good and evil lives had no end, because the soul had no end. The soul was eternal. From these and many of the other sources and materials we've been utilizing, we have a perspective then of the ancient gods and their practice and doctrines in Central America. For those who are interested in the archaeological background, as such, in order to place perspective to Book of Mormon times and to the archaeological history of the Central Americans, a book by Richard E. W. Adams called The Prehistoric Mesoamerica is one of the more recent archaeological texts that would give a person a chronological setting. Then there are other newer books that could also be mentioned in terms of their validity and the material that they provide. Some of these are mentioned in tape number 82, dealing with discoveries that confirm the Book of Mormon, and a book called Burning Water by Loretta Sojourné, a French archaeologist residing in Mexico City. Her source material, not utilized here, is very valuable and provides a great deal of information concerning the Mesoamerican parallels to Mormon and the Book of Mormon material. Now we might say a little word about parallels as such. As we've quoted from these ancient documents and provided insight into the things that have come down and been inherited and we can now understand that the ancients understood in their own time, we find specifically that nothing we can do can prove the Book of Mormon as such, but that the content of the Book of Mormon standing alone or the doctrines of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we might expect, as it says in the Book of Mormon, that to every nation was given sufficient for their needs. And then as great apostasies crept in, the doctrines become transformed, modified, and bizarre and perverted material added. The experts are only now, with access to the great documents and books that are available, being able to go into the lower levels, level by level, and finally get to the underlying rich source material that confirms some of the earlier predecessor doctrines that are now contained in the documents we have available. Tape 116 was a very rapid run-through of the discovery of codices. There are many more now being recovered. Recently in Chiapas, Mexico, a codice covered with calcite was recovered. No one yet has been able to determine the exact chemistry by which they can take this codice and remove the calcite and see exactly what might be inside. There are a number of individuals who are dedicated to the study of interpretation, beginning with Dr. Thompson and others, the ancient Maya writings. But at this present time, 70% to 90% of the codices we now have in our possession, we cannot read. We cannot understand. The little bit that we've been able to present in these three tapes, small as insignificant compared to what might be the content and the valuable parallels and considerations once we're able to break that particular ancient writing or the ancient glyphic writing. But that will happen in time. On page 25 of the Book of Mormon, we have information concerning the fact that Gentiles will find books, plural, that will confirm the Book of Mormon. These are expectations yet for the future. Preparations are being made now on a vast scale. We see this rather extensive and worldwide. As waste paper baskets in Dresden yield up ancient codices that were sent back by conquistadors, private collections in London are finally becoming estates and being gifted to museums, and then ancient documents show up that their existence were not even known. Gifts were sent back by the conquistadores consisting of ancient folding-out books, these accordion-like books, and now from various families and estates, these are being brought to museums after hundreds of years. And so we can expect a slowly accumulating avalanche of documentary sources to be forthcoming, and then someone, perhaps alive right now, will be able to be endowed with sufficient insight to cope with the ancient Maya glyphs and be able to read the stelas that are available. Over the years, some 12,000 ruins have been identified in Central America alone, which is the subject material of just these documents, and less than 5% have been excavated, and only a few hundred of those to any great depth. Chronologically, the systems now to date the ancient ruins are being developed, and we come to an understanding, therefore, that there are ruin areas geographically located to some extent, if we follow a basic Book of Mormon geography, and time-wise, chronologically-wise, from the Jaredite period, 2000 B.C., clear through to the 400 A.D. period. So a 2,400 to 2,800-year history is represented in the Book of Mormon. The doctrines presented in 1830 are being unqualifiably, undeniably found and very unique in many respects in these ancient recovered documents. What's next on the scene for discovery? We don't know. We can anticipate it. It'll be most exciting and most interesting. Some of the most important material, perhaps, for individuals interested in pursuing these discoveries are the books by the Dominican friar Diego Duran. Just recently, his Book of the Gods and the Rites was translated and published by the University of Oklahoma Press. And then the Codex Perez and the Book of Shalom Balam became available. In an episode in northern Yucatan, which was most exciting, I realized that the Mayas today still believe in Shalom Balam. The recovery of those ancient records and prophecies are most exciting. Page 54 of the book He Walked the Americas by L. Taylor Hansen has an interesting tree of life representation, and she mentions again the coming of the white gods. But there's still legends of the Shalom Balam dealing with how the natives of Central America will be returned to their land, and how all of the material before the arrival of Christianity will be reinstated, because they believe that Christianity today is a corruption, and they try to resort in many of their various areas back to their original forms. In Guatemala, for example, there's a group of Council of 12 and a baptismal practice that after the sprinkling ceremonies of tiny babies, that at a later date, reserved not for infants, but for older people, the children are rebaptized. This was found in the ancient practices for Central America when the conquistadores arrived. Now, nothing has been mentioned in any of the discussions in tape 117, 118, this present tape, of the South American materials, the Inca, and those
populated areas south of Colombia. There's a great deal, likewise, recovered for these areas, and that material will be the subject of future tapes. There's a great book called Four Masterworks of American Indian Literature, edited by John Bierhorst. It includes the Night Chant of the Navajo, and a future tape will be prepared on the Navajo and his relationship, and a very peculiar ritual that the Navajos go through, which it traced back is most interesting. Some of the priests of the Navajo group go to the Gulf of California, and there they offer a special ceremony as a result of a shipwrecked boat that seemed to have occurred in that vicinity. There's the ritual of condolence that has never been really explored. It's now available in English translation. And also the Chucheb, a tremendous piece of Indian literature. And in the Four Masterworks of American Indian Literature, those three, along with the great works of Quetzalcoatl, have now been made available in English. People then availing themselves of such material can work out for themselves more details concerning the relationship of gods and doctrines of Central America to the Mormon unique doctrines and practices. Nearly all these books I've been referring to here have been made available in the last 6 or 7 years. There's also a study that was made as a result of the Holt History of Religion series called Pre-Columbian American Religions. And perhaps a few statements from that will be of interest. The great God of ancient Mexico shares many of the attributes possessed by the supreme being in other religions. The Aztecs regarded him as the only true God, omnipresent and intangible as the night wind, which was a name they also gave him, while at the same time he was the supporter of life and by whom we live. He was our father and our mother, in the sense of a duality there, who sent the seeds of children into their mother's womb from on high, who made human beings grow, who fed them, the Lord of our flesh. He was male and female at once. In the fourth chapter of Abraham, 27th verse, what does that mean? He was male and female at once. You may want to look into that. Thus combining the functions of beginning and childbearing, hence his title, the God of Duality. He was male and female. The Godhead of any particular exalted group would be a husband and wife, exalted for eternity. Now, the Supreme Being, according to this book, played a great pre-existent action, but they note that the Supreme Being played no direct part in the creation. The creation was done by Quetzalcoatl and an individual, Tezcatlipoca. Creation was delegated to Quetzalcoatl and may be regarded as his manifestation. Both Quetzalcoatl and Tezcatlipoca are considered to be sons of the Supreme God. They even share some of his titles. They're in constant contest. Now, the cult of Quetzalcoatl originated among the Mixtecs and those Nahuatl tribes which stood under the Mixtec influence and was carried by them to places as far afield as Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua. And the cult of Tezcatlipoca rose among the Toltecs of post-classic times and the older Nahuatl tribes of the Valley of Mexico and the Puebla Valley. Apart from their basic roles as creators, Quetzalcoatl and Tezcatlipoca frequently appear as adversaries of each other as they continue. Now, Quetzalcoatl personifies the godhood and the godhead in its light-bearing positive aspects, and Tezcatlipoca personifies it in its dark negative aspect. The alter ego of Tezcatlipoca was the jaguar, that of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent. And anyone familiar with the architecture of Central America and Mesoamerica will easily see those two motifs constantly repeated again and again. However, predominance of the jaguar occurs after 400 and 500, particularly 700 AD. This may have significant historical purpose and meaning. Some of the recent materials now coming out of Central America are the discoveries of the Olmec. The book on the earliest American civilization, the Olmec, by Coe, should be referred to and is a most exciting source because it parallels the Girardite record in particular. There was a special symposium held in Dumbarton Oaks back east wherein discussions were made and carried on concerning the Olmecs and many of their conclusions now published have certain Book of Mormon parallels as such. The total geography is the most exciting thing. There's a book in progress of being proofread in preparation by John Sorensen at the Department of Anthropology at Brigham Young University, and others are constantly considering and reconsidering the geography of the Book of Mormon. Sooner or later, as excavations occur throughout Central America, identifications may eventually be expected. This would be most exciting. However, does the Book of Mormon require this kind of proof? No. Internally, it has its own. And there's the request in the 10th chapter of Moroni that an individual in prayerful humility solicit from deity confirmation, the indelible impress of the Holy Spirit, that he might understand the Book of Mormon. Proving the Book of Mormon is not a necessary activity as such, but since the Book of Mormon promises and even accounts and gives accounting of individuals who have prepared documents and states that discoveries will be made, then we can, those of us who are keenly interested in the totality of the church and its relationship, have expectation for the discoveries yet to come. Much of the Book of Mormon content, however, need not be totally confirmed by Mesoamerican discoveries, because the Book of Mormon also contains the brass plates, containing a history from the time of Adam down to about 600 B.C. References are constantly made to the ancient brass plates. These references now are finding confirmation in other discoveries being made worldwide. There was the Jewish milieu, likewise, in terms of the Book of Mormon's origins. From the time of Zedekiah the king, about 588 B.C. And these now are being confirmed, much of it, in terms of discoveries being made in Egypt and elsewhere. Tape 97 provides information on the text of Zosimus, which may have an interesting parallel to Central America, wherein an individual was in vision transported here and may have had a contact with Central Americans. There's also the Elephantine archives, so beautifully confirming Book of Mormon names, described in detail in two previous tapes that have been prepared by my son Ty Erickson. Tape 103 in particular deals with the Elephantine archives, and then more detail from the Elephantine archives provided, along with other discoveries in Assyria and the Far East, called the Murosa documents in tape 112, and the Ebla discoveries. Where did Joseph Smith get his 200 names or more? Unique prefixes and suffixes are found, and roots. Confirmation of the names is rather extraordinary. Individuals who have taken contest with the Book of Mormon, both in terms of its origins and source, on the basis that the young prophet Joseph Smith could have somehow or another, from the sources available to him, 1827 to 1830, have been the sole source of the content of the Book of Mormon, now have to explain these worldwide confirmational parallels and source materials and linear records that go so close to the Book of Mormon, historically and otherwise. A great deal of the source material now available in Central America and South America is in Spanish, French, and German. Individuals working in those regions will have to be familiar with those languages in order to cope with all the material becoming available. The Plumed Serpent by José Diaz Bolio is a tremendous volume. I have it here before me, where he goes clear through all the details of every source that he can acquire at this moment and updates it up to his time dealing with the Quetzalcoatl material. It would take several tapes just to discuss the details of that alone. A useful book for anyone working in ancient Middle America is the book compiled by Kurt Mooser. It's a glossary of terms and words used in archaeology and the art history of pre-Columbian Mexico and Central America. It's called Facts and Artifacts of Ancient Middle America. It's like a dictionary. It'll also provide certain information concerning the pronunciation of a number of the names. There are two different methods of pronunciation, and Beerhorst provides one of the methods. You have the Nahua pronunciation and an Aztec pronunciation. They do vary a little, so you'll sometimes hear people giving the gods' names a little differently, and that would be the reason why, depending on which one they use. The study, then, of the Western Hemisphere involving the Book of Mormon, gods, and doctrines really can be broken down into four segments then. North America, and here we include the tremendous activities of the Hopi, the Taos, and the Navajo. All three of these major cultural Indian groups, many of which are joining the church today, have confirmational earlier doctrines and practices that parallel the Book of Mormon. Among the Hopis themselves, contrary to the evolutionists and the anthropologists, the Hopis trace their ancestry, their beginnings, down to the south. And with place names and certain ceremonies and traditions, account how they came across the sea, landed on a western shore, survived for a period of time, and then migrated under the instructions of their young god to take their seed belts and to go north. They traced their journey along the Colorado River up into the present areas of northern Arizona and southwest Colorado and southern Utah and parts of New Mexico. So we have to take larger account now, and many records, tapings are being made of knowledgeable, tribal, informed individuals. One or two more generations, and it'll be most difficult to get such oral material. The second is the Central American itself, Middle America or Mesoamerica, as it's sometimes called. Here we have then the great highlands of Guatemala. Things there are most interesting and exciting. Discoveries are being made all the time. One of the largest cities of all, Merida, is being excavated by students from Brigham Young University and other participants, with funds now being generated because it appears it'll be one of the very largest and oldest ruins found in Central America, easily dating to back to 600 BC. Evidence is there when fully excavated, and it'll take years, will be of great interest. There are vast areas of the Pitan jungle that are unprospected, unexplored, but aerial photography has been most useful in identifying ruins of extraordinary character and nature. And then the third segment is the South American. Many of the Inca and other ruins, however, are 800 to 1100 AD, and therefore they post-date much of the Central American areas by 800 years to 1,000 years. However, there are earlier periods in the Peru, Bolivian, and other cultural areas, and as excavations and studies transpire there, linkage to the chronological histories will be made, and undoubtedly a tremendous amount of material will again support the widespread and extensive activities of the Central American and early Nephite Lamanite groups as they spread abroad in the lands. And the fourth segment, which we briefly mentioned then, are the related documents and source materials of the rest of the world, the South Pacific origins and parallels, as given in tape 119. Also those in Japan. Elder Kikuchi indicated a year or two ago that he had enough material now that he could possibly write a book on the appearance or tradition of Christ's appearance in Japan. There's also the Scandinavian linkages, Middle Eastern linkages, and others elsewhere. So it's exciting. At this period in time, we can take the Book of Mormon and use it as a guidebook, seriously consider all of its content, geography, history, doctrines, and find confirmation of that unique book that in 84 days the young prophet Joseph Smith brought to the world. We've not been required to retract any of it by all the discoveries made, nor do we ever expect to. The single fact is that the Book of Mormon is a revealed history of ancient peoples, and it behooves each of us as individuals, while this is all nice to know, to get an understanding of the great Joseph who brought it and presented it to the world. And he himself, with great expectation, said it would probably be justified to examine the great cities of Guatemala and others for possible identifications with cities of the Book of Mormon. His own interest and study was pursued along those lines, and we today can continue such pursuits, but remembering in all respects that it is the Spirit to guide us and lead us, and our testimony is dependent upon Him. May we get the witness of the Holy Spirit and keep it in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.